Joining us now, man, he knows a lot about this game we call golf. It's Fairways of Life with Matt Adams. What's going on this morning, Matt?
Hey, Mark. Hey, Matt. How are you guys?
Good, Matt.
Man, we're doing good. You know, where do you hold the state of the game right now? I mean, we got Tiger Woods back. He's on his game. He's already got a W under his belt at the Tour Championship last year. What's the state of the game right now for you?
I think it comes down to, are you a person that likes a sport that has parity, or are you a person that likes a sport that has dominance? And having Tiger back in the winner's circle with winning the Tour Championship, everybody that wants the dominant side and the side of Tiger to come back and be all that he was are hoping that he will somehow channel the Tiger that was. What I like about what Tiger's doing now is it's a new Tiger. He's not the Tiger of old, although if you look at the top 100 players in the world rankings, nobody ascended faster over the last 12 months. He started the year at 656, and he ended it at 13th. Now, granted, the climb from 13th to number one is an extremely steep one, but given the ascent that he's had, it's quite possible that Tiger could become the number one ranked player in the world again. I don't see him becoming the dominant player that he once was for one reason, because today's players, by and large, don't have the same fear factor, the same intimidation of Tiger Woods as they once had, but he is Tiger Woods, and I do think that he's capable of becoming the best of the best again in the world rankings and winning multiple times and winning major championships. That, coupled with the likes of, you know, young guns like Cameron Champ that hit it a mile, and guys like Brooks Koepka and Dustin Johnson that have it, and then you've got Justin Thomas and you got Jordan Spieth in the mix. I love where the game is at right now. From a fan's perspective, I think we're in one of the golden ages of the game.
I agree with that, Matt. And I was, you know, the interesting thing is you hear people, these younger guys say to the older guys, I wish I'd have played in Tiger's prime, and every one of those older guys say, oh, no, you don't. You don't understand.
Yeah, right? Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, what do you make of somebody like a Cameron Champ? I mean, we know he's hitting it a ton. I mean, you know, he's hitting it 350 yards like it's nobody's business. I mean, is he going to be able to sustain this, or is this just kind of the flash in the pan? We see that a lot out of guys sometimes, is that, you know, they everything kind of falls in place. They have a nice little run, and then next thing you know, you don't hear a whole lot from these guys. I mean, is Cameron a guy that can handle the pressure maybe of, you know, now that he's won, going into golf tournaments saying, man, this guy hits it a long way. He's got a chance to win every week. I mean, can he handle that kind of pressure going forward?
You know, it's interesting. If you look at the best of the best over the last, say, three or four decades, and where you have players, the way you describe it, that are flash in the pan, generally they are very type A personalities. They're capable of coming out at any individual shot, getting home in two on any par five, you know, shooting a course record, et cetera, winning by record margins. But sooner or later, they're consumed by the fire that burns within. I don't see that with Cameron Champ at all. Cameron Champ is incredibly level-headed. Everybody focuses on his prodigious driving, and rightfully so. Last season, he led the web.com in driving at over 343 yards. But when he won, look closely at his stats. He did as much damage with the short game, and in particular with the putter, as he did with the driver in hand. And if that piece of equipment, the putter that tends to defy those that really burn that hot, kind of like a flaming comet across the sky, I don't see that happening with Cameron Champ. His coach is Sean Foley. I reached out to Shawnee because I was doing a feature on Cameron for my Golf Channel work. And Sean Foley, this is a guy that currently is working with on-again, off-again world number one, Justin Rose, and has worked with Tiger Woods. And Sean Foley told me that Cameron Champ is the most naturally talented athlete that he has ever worked with. And what's more, he doesn't just solely focus on what his strengths are. And again, we can have a discussion as to what those are versus perception and reality. But he actually focuses on what he perceives to be his weaknesses. So he's a kid that, instead of, in my mind, being concerned about will he be able to sustain, he's still growing into the role. He's still getting better, and that's the thing that's scary good.
Yeah, I was watching the RSM yesterday afternoon, and it just, his demeanor is just, he is so perfect for golf. I mean, he just doesn't seem to, he has no ups and downs, or so it seems, and he's just solid. I mean, the guy is, I mean, I'm really impressed so far. with Cameron Champ.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Yeah. I absolutely agree with that assessment. If you look at the likes of a Brooks Koepka, a Dustin Johnson, for those guys, it took them a while to grow into the greatness that they now possess. But all of those players, of which Harmon described Dustin to me one time, he said, it's like water off a duck's back. Nothing seems to bother him. Brooks is the same way. Nothing seems to bother him. At the Ryder Cup, it was Sunday singles, and I was assigned to do play-by-play. I was following Brooks Koepka against Paul Casey. And if you guys remember, the par four fourth hole was kind of an uphill par four.
Right.
And they had put fairway bunkers in, and they had narrowed the fairway. And, of course, everyone knows about how brutal the rough was to a raised green complex and a tucked left pin. And Brooks hit it into that new fairway bunker. Casey gets up there with a hybrid and just slides it into the middle of fairway. Perfect releases. He had about 175 left. I was working with Gordon Brand Jr., himself a two-time European Ryder Cup team member, and he whispers in my ear before we go on, and he said, Matty, he can't get home. He's talking about Brooks. He can't get home from there. That bunker is too deep, and he's nestled down into it too far. Brooks gets up there like some type of Nordic god, slashes at the ball, puts it to about 11 feet from the hole. That's Brooks Koepka. He just can power it and do things that other players can't do.
Yeah,
very impressive.
That reminded me of Tiger's bunker shot on Monday morning that year. I guess I can't remember the tournament, but he is that was the best bunker shot I've ever seen, bar none. A fairway bunker shot. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you. Club head speed, but the ability to get the ball up and the ability to do something fearless because he had to cover water, too. It's amazing.
Matt, you've interviewed everybody in the game, and you've been called the best golf interviewer of all time by a lot of these players. Who were a couple of your favorite interviews of all time?
I would say the top of the vine for me would probably be Charlie Sifford.
Really?
I had a chance to speak with Mr. Sifford when he was in his late 80s.
Wow.
And the amount of emotion from that man, remember, he was denied being able to play at Augusta National. He was leading the Canadian Open, which traditionally had been given an automatic berth into the Masters. And while he was leading, there was a sign posted in the locker room that said that this year, there will not be an automatic berth to the Masters for the winner of the Canadian Open. Of course, he saw that. He knew that.
Yeah.
And he spoke to me about the death threats that he received. He spoke to me about the injustices that he suffered. And he did all this just because he wanted to pursue his passion, his love for playing the game of golf. It was the type of interview that, as I'm doing it, it was a telephone interview. And as I'm doing the interview, I'm literally welling up listening to this man's story and amazed by the fact that we all collectively, all of us, Matt and Mark and fans, have been lucky enough to live through an era when these greats, these people that have forged paths and defined the game, have been alive. And we've been able to talk to them and hear from them and learn from them. And I guess the second one, very close to that, would be Arnold Palmer, where we did a sit-down interview, and I think it's still posted on YouTube. It was a video interview, and we've used the audio many times, too. We had this chance to speak with Mr. Palmer. I think it was his last full, unstructured interview, where we just talked about whatever we wanted to. And my favorite part of the interview was we got to a point where I said to Mr. Palmer, if you would allow, I'm just going to throw a name at you, and you give me your reaction. And we went Walter Hagen and Bobby Jones, I mean, Jack Nicklaus, Gary Player, Ben Hogan, Sam Snead. We just went down the list like that, and he gave me his instant reaction to it. In some cases, it was revealing. In every case, it was still fascinating. So those are two that kind of stand out to me.
Again, we're talking with Matt Adams from Fairways of Life with Matt Adams. And, Matt, you brought up the Ryder Cup, and you were there, and you know, we've had Matt and I have had some discussions about the Ryder Cup for the last, you know, month and a half or so since it ended. You know, what really went wrong at the Ryder Cup? And you know, we hear a lot. We talked to Robert Carlson, who was a vice captain on the European squad, and we you know, we talk about the Europeans seem to have more passion for the Ryder Cup. I won't say that they care more about the Ryder Cup. They just seem to have more passion about it. But for you, was it a pairings thing? Was it a the guy's not meshing. I mean, we know the Patrick Reed story. We've heard about Brooks Koepka and Dustin Johnson, you know, maybe getting into a little bit of a scuffle. But at this point, I guess we're kind of passing that off as, you know, two buddies who just had a little disagreement. They maybe shoved each other a little bit, and now it's over. But what kind of went wrong for you at the Ryder Cup?
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, the Ryder Cup's a very unique event to cover. And the reason why it's so unique is because there's so many people there. There are in excess of 50,000 people on the golf course every day, and there's only a few matches out there. So you can imagine that every hole that they're on have tens of thousands of people. That's why that woman got so badly injured when Dustin Johnson's drive went wayward and hit her in the eye. There's just so many people packed in there, it's impossible not to be around other souls. So because of that fact, even in the role that I have, I'm on top of the players all the time. I can hear what they're saying. I can see their interactions as human being to human being. And my first observation about the Ryder Cup is that it isn't so much a story about what went wrong. That's what we're focusing on in this side of the pond, as it is a story about what went right. The European team, first of all, plays a regular European Tour event at that golf course. The golf course is not a course upon which you can impose a game. It is a golf course that you have to play the nuance. Some of the holes look like they could be in West Palm Beach, as you may be familiar with the finish. Some of them, like the 12th, looks like a hole that would be at La Hinch. It's got a raised green complex that's exposed and sweeping with steps of chipping areas and runouts that surround it, windswept, such as it is. So it's this variety of golf course where every single hole has to be taken in as a strategy. The American team, by and large, tried to come in and play the golf course in the way in which they play most PGA Tour events, and that is to dominate it. The vast majority of the time I watched Americans tee off, they were hitting more club than the Europeans were. The Europeans were hitting the little nuanced club and shaping it into the fairway. The Americans were not missing the fairway by much, in fairness, but where they were missing, they got into some very deep rough. So from that standpoint, the way that the Europeans managed themselves, the way that the Europeans managed the setup of the golf course, the way that the Europeans approached this kind of selfless attitude at the Ryder Cup is, to me, the reason why they came out on top. Having said that, I think too much focus and emphasis is being placed upon this search for the elusive to say, you know, let's tear this house down and rebuild it again because we lost this Ryder Cup. I actually think that Jim Furyk was a good Ryder Cup captain. I think he did a good job in representing the United States and getting his team ready to play. Ultimately, he doesn't hit the shot that they hit, and I do think that there was a mistake made in strategy. I think that a lot of the success that the European side has historically over the last few decades, and it's right in front of our nose. They, by and large, play Ryder Cups at home on courses upon which they play European Tour events. The captaincies of their teams and vice captaincies are one of ascendancy. It's not an honorary position. It's not something that's thrust upon someone into the role. It's something that they evolve into. And the players, when they come to compete, are doing it with a team attitude. They're coming on, and I'm saying coach, and they're all agreeing that whatever it takes, captain, to be a team is the way that they're approaching it. So there's some things that they do on their side that, again, are right in front of us. And I think if we take a look at that, it would help the American side. But when it's all said and done, golf happens, sport happens, and I don't think there's really a smoking gun behind it.
Yeah, and Mark had mentioned, you know, he didn't think it's the most important thing to him. But, you know, I asked Robert Carlson a few weeks ago, you know, Francesco Molinari was quoted as saying he'd rather win the Ryder Cup than a major golf tournament. And I'm not sure that's totally true, but I think that's more of the way they think than we do, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, my theory on that is that if you look at the evolution of the Ryder Cup from its origins at the Worcester Country Club to running into the Second World War. Now, after the Second World War, as we all know, Europe was devastated. And for years, this ragtag group of Great Britain and Ireland team would come over to compete against the American side, and summarily they would be crushed. In 1967, when Ben Hogan was captaining, it was an absolute slaughtering of that side. The very next Ryder Cup in 1969 was the famed concession because they had Tony Jacklin, this young superstar, up against Jack Nicklaus, and Jack Nicklaus conceded that last putt. Right. The Americans, this is a piece that kind of flips through the pages of history, still kept the Ryder Cup. They retained it with what took place. But Sam Snead was the captain, and he reportedly sneered to Nicholas, "We didn't come over here to be good old boys." And keep in mind, his arch rival Ben Hogan was the immediate past captain, and he had a dominating win. Sam Snead ended up coming back to the United States with merely a half. But like Jack Nicklaus had this ability to do through actions, he seemed to grasp the importance of the future, and it started to change the perspective of the Ryder Cup. Yes, the Americans still dominated after that, but instead of showing up looking like they've got a mismatched set of clubs, an old worn bag and shoes and sweater on, the European side finally came together at the end of the 1970s, and then they finally had the vision to put Tony Jacklin in as captain. And the first thing Tony did was to say, "We need equal footing as the American team. We need the same clothes. We need the same meeting room. We need the same travel." And they had to concede, and they did ultimately. That changed everything. Yeah. So if you look at that from that perspective, the European side still plays with this kind of have-not type of attitude, coming in and saying, "Look, we know that you guys think you're better than us. We know that you're higher ranked than us, and you may have more major championships and all the rest. But we're going to come in there." That's the reason why they owe every single Ryder Cup. Mark me on this, guys. Every time there's an argument about who the underdog team is, because they fuel their passion with this idea of, "You don't think we're as good as you guys are, and we're going to show you otherwise."
Well, Matt, man, we appreciate you coming on with us. Remind everybody where they can catch up with you Monday through Friday.
I'm on Golf Central early in the week, morning drive, whenever they need me on the equipment side of Golf Channel, and then the Fairways of Life show is live every day at 8 a.m. Eastern time. Fairways of Life app for iPhone and Android, and you can also hear it live on fairwaysoflife.com.
All right, Matt, we appreciate you coming on. Thanks a lot, man.
Thanks, guys. See you.